Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and earned a PhD in history from the University of Pittsburgh. He is a professor at Hillsdale College and holds the Charles Klein Chair in History and Management. He is also a senior fellow in economic education for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. He has authored 8 books, the newest entitled Uncle Sam Can't Count. His name, Bert Folsom Jr., and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Bert Folsom, who, amongst other things, is a senior fellow in economic education for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Bert, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's good to be with you today.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and was interested in history at an early age and ended up pursuing it through middle school, high school, and then college. I majored in history. I had a PhD in history, economic history. That led to my interest in the United States and how it was an exceptional nation founded on principles of individual liberty. And so a lot of my research career has been looking at the impact of the freedom on the growth of the United States and the ultimate triumph of the United States as an economic power.
Bert, what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
I think the biggest thing I learned from my mother was attention to detail. That attention to detail is not only important, but it often makes the difference between success and failure. For my father, it was more on the ideas that my father was a World War II vet, so the idea of liberty, the idea that you'd have to fight to defend your liberty, he was also in the Korean War. He was in both, World War II, and served as at least as a consultant in the Korean War. And so the idea that you'd have to defend our liberties, that they're precious, why we would defend them, and why they're worth defending was an important thing that I got from my father.
Why did you decide to spend your life in education?
Well, I think that teaching is an opportunity to have influence. If you think about it, there, for example, your career, Jack, in radio, somebody in journalism, it's a chance to reach a lot of people. It's an opportunity to exert influence. I think in politics you have an opportunity to also exert influence, but I think teaching as well. I think those three, some aspect of communication or journalism, politics, and teaching, is a chance to have an impact on many, many lives. In other words, if the ideas I believe are important, that individual liberty works, that increasing the size of government does not work and has counter effects that are very negative for society. If those ideas that I believe are good ideas, then teaching is a good way to discuss those ideas with students, to create people who are willing to not only participate in a free society effectively, perhaps become entrepreneurs themselves, but people who can take that defense of liberty to the next generation.
We're talking about Bert Folsom Jr. of Hillsdale College. Bert, what separates a great teacher from a good teacher?
Well, a great teacher has an influence, a long-run influence on his students, whereas a good teacher, I think, has a shorter-run influence. So that often requires not only affecting students with the quality of the ideas that you're communicating. I think that's important, but also being available to the students to discuss those ideas, to answer questions, and to nurture the students along a bit. And that's not easy because you have a lot of students come along down the pike. Teaching at Hillsdale College, we have smaller classes. The largest class I teach is 30 students. And so I can work more individually with students. When I've taught at places that have larger enrollments, I can't possibly meet with all the students. The chance, the opportunity, I think, to be a great teacher is the opportunity to influence those students' minds, teach them the ideas that are durable, that work, to make this society work, and to answer the questions to allow them to move on to the next level. I think those are the marks of a good teacher, or great teacher, I should say.
Bert, you teach and listen to and talk to millennials every day. Tell us about millennials.
Well, the millennials are, I would say about 80% of talking and teaching millennials is the same as it was when I was 18 to 22, because human nature has not changed. People respond to incentives. People respond to a good story. People respond to something that resonates with them, that works. People have loves, hates. They want to succeed. We're influenced by a lot of the same things, so that really much of the job is exactly the same. Now, there are some differences, too, because I'm 40, 50 years separated. When I wrote my PhD dissertation, it was on a typewriter, and that would be unimaginable to a millennial today. In fact, a millennial might not even know what a typewriter carriage is. So you get those differences. Millennials are cell phone people, they're Twitter people, they're constantly in touch. But there are differences. You have to be able to communicate in different ways sometimes with them. Like in Twitter, you have to be able to get your thought across in 140 characters sometimes. But I think that that's a good thing. It forces us to be succinct. And as I say, I think the similarities are greater than the differences. So I just have to be aware that the nature of communication is changing and the nature of innovation is changing, and try to work within those new boundaries as best I understand them to communicate a lot of age-old ideas that work 100 years ago, they work 50 years ago, and they work today. Liberty is a good thing, and it produces good results for society.
When we come back, we'll ask Bert Folsom about Hillsdale College. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Bert Folsom, who holds the Charles Klein Chair in History and Management at Hillsdale College. Bert, you drive to central southern Michigan, down 127, get off, go west on US 12, Michigan Avenue, drive to nowhere, and suddenly you come upon this world-class campus, Hillsdale College. How did it get there?
Well, Hillsdale College was founded on the basis of ideas, the same way the United States was. Just as the United States was founded on the idea of natural rights, that God gave us all a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that we need to write a constitution to protect those God-given rights. Just as we were founded that way as a nation, Hillsdale College was founded on freedom as well. It was founded in 1844 in the midst of the opposition to slavery. And freedom and slavery obviously connect very closely as two polar opposites. And Hillsdale College was a campus that wanted to free slaves. We were the second campus in the nation to integrate, have an integrated student body. We accepted blacks, whites, males, females, and were committed to that. During the Civil War, we sent practically our whole, every male student practically at Hillsdale went off to fight in the Union Army. We had a part of the Underground Railroad came through the Hillsdale area so that students were helping slaves achieve freedom. Individual liberty has been we received no federal aid, of course, in the 1800s, and then also in the 1900s and today. Hillsdale College was founded on Judeo-Christian principles, belief in God, belief in individual liberty, belief in natural rights, and we are fighting for those same values today. And it's a very distinctive campus with students who are committed to pursue excellence. Students who want to read, maybe not all of them, but students who are willing to work hard to achieve something.
Bert, very, very, very few colleges, universities don't take government money. Hillsdale's one of them. Why?
Yes. Grove City College and Hillsdale College are about the only two left. And Hillsdale takes no money because the Constitution did not, in Article 1, Section 8, allow Congress to give money for education. And so Hillsdale College wants to pursue its development in a constitutional manner, and we don't think that that's authorized under the Constitution. Now, obviously, the courts have said otherwise, but Hillsdale College, we believe that we should continue to pursue an education with people paying for their own education or contributors to the college helping to defray those costs. We believe the government should not be involved, that when the government is involved, that it politicizes education, as it has done, as it is currently doing, for example, even on the student loan issue. And so Hillsdale College remains independent. And because we have independence, we can run our college the way that we think is best for the students. And the students respond to this. We still have low tuition, and we are able to attract a national group. We attract from all over the nation, and even some foreign students. And we get good students. We get very good students who've often been extremely excellent where they grew up and where they went to high school. And those students come together here at Hillsdale. And those students are going to make a difference in the way the world works.
If Dr. Arnold's listening, the president of Hillsdale, he might be thinking, I couldn't have said it better.
Dr. Arn has been a big contributor to the progress of Hillsdale College. He's been here for about 13, 14 years, not just with the buildings, although the campus has changed a lot, looks a lot better than it did when he came. But he's pursuing our online education. See, part of what we're talking about, Jack, is making a difference in the world. Now, I can make a difference. I mean, I've written a book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. I wrote Uncle Sam Can't Count. I wrote a book against the New Deal that showed the problems of big government, a book called New Deal or Raw Deal. That's good. I think it makes a difference. Dr. Arn wants to take us to online education. And we now have courses that have reached hundreds of thousands of people online, and people can have courses in the Constitution. We have one in American history, even in rhetoric and great books. And we're putting together a curriculum that people free can begin to see some of what we're doing here at Hillsdale College.
If you want to learn more about Bert, www.bertfolsom.com. Speaking of reaching people throughout the world, in 1971, Hillsdale starts something called Imprimis, which now reaches 2.8 readers six times a year. Tell us about Imprimis.
Right. As you say, we're reaching almost 3 million readers. Imprimis comes out once a month. That is an essay or an article that's usually taken from a speech that was given at Hillsdale College. And that article emphasizes some aspect of the principles of liberty. And we get a range of excellent people contributing to Imprimis. And those essays reach a lot of people. And I think that that is where a lot of the people outside the Hillsdale, Michigan, Indiana radius, Ohio radius, hear about Hillsdale. They get Imprimis, and their parents will sometimes read essays and show them to the children. And they say, hey, let's look into this campus. What we try to do then is just say, hey, visit the campus. As you said, Jack, it's in a remote place in southern Michigan. Come to the campus. We have about 1,400 students. See what you think of the classes. Meet some of the students. And if it's for you, you will know it. And most of the students I talk with, when I ask them why they came here, sometimes they'll say, well, I read an article in Imprimis and I liked it. And they'll say, I came to campus, and once I saw what was happening in the classrooms, the interactions with the professors, and once I met a few of the students, I knew this is where I wanted to come.
If you want to learn more about Hillsdale, www.hillsdale.edu. Bert, if one of your former students said, you changed my life, I'm going to buy a one-minute Super Bowl commercial. And Professor Folsom, I want you to tell America your basic message you try to get across to your students and your readers. Bert, what would you tell America?
Yeah. Go Detroit Lions, huh? I would say America is an exceptional nation. It's the only nation founded on principles, God-given rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. My study of history, I want to show how that has made a difference in the world, how America went from a second-rate country to a first-rate country because our entrepreneurs had the freedom to invest. They created in railroads, airplanes, automobiles, Henry Ford, a lot of it happening in Michigan, Will Kellogg. And these inventions and this creativity made America distinct. I write about that in my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons, but also I point out that when we went to going to big government with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, it failed. Political corruption increased, gross national product went down, jobs disappeared, and the United States has been in trouble a little bit over the last 80 years, ever since we went to bigger government with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. I express that in my book, New Deal or Raw Deal. Important principles. Liberty works. Big government often has problems.
Why does private enterprise do better than government enterprise?
No, that's a great question, Jack, because it wouldn't seem that it necessarily would. In other words, why does an individually run enterprise do better than one run by the government, which after all has limitless resources? It ought to do better. The theme in the book Uncle Sam Can't Count that I just did is again and again and again. Look at railroads, look at steamships, look at the fur trade, look at the chemical industry, look at the invention of the airplane. In every single example, you have government efforts to try to invent products, and you have individual companies, people, often poor people, succeeding where the government failed. And I think the incentives, I'd say number one, the incentives are different. When you're spending your own money working on your own project, you have every incentive to learn as much as you can about it and spend carefully. Try to work for solutions carefully because it's your money. When you're spending somebody else's money, the government money, the process becomes politicized. Politics comes into play. Politicians appoint political fellow politicians, or at least people connected with their political group, get appointed into leadership positions. Those people don't have the incentives to excel. If the company takes off and grows, they don't necessarily get the benefits, so they don't have an incentive to innovate, just keep things moving along at a slow pace. And so we see time and again, very rarely in American history, do we see a government-run or heavily government-supported enterprise working well. But often we'll see private companies and corporations who are influenced by the profit motive and incentives, we see them work very well.
We're talking to Bert Folsom. When we come back, we'll ask him about some of his heroes who have made America great. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasul, and we're with Bert Folsom, whose articles have appeared in The Wall Street Journal, Investor's Business, Washington Times, on and on and on and on. Bert, let's talk about a few of your heroes who have made America great. The Wright brothers, please.
The Wright brothers, I have a separate chapter in Uncle Sam Can't Count because their story is so fantastic. Those are two bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio, who took about $1,500 of their own money and invented an airplane. They were not even considered on the radar as possible inventors of the airplane. The United States and other nations had been subsidizing different so-called experts to try to invent the airplane first, because naturally, you want to be the nation that has the first airplane, because then you can fly over the other guy's country and maybe drop something on them. The airplane was considered a strategic military invention. And Germany, England, and France all were pursuing it. And in the case of Germany, subsidizing people to try to help them invent the airplane. In the case of the United States, we subsidized Samuel Langley. We subsidized him for two flights. He was head of the Smithsonian Institution. He was considered one of the greatest scientists of the era. He had honorary doctorates from Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard and Yale. He already had some inventions to his credit, and he had already flown a model, a miniature airplane across the Potomac, or at least around the Potomac. And so he looked like a good person to invest in. The government funded him for two ventures. They both went flying right into the Potomac River. They just plopped into the Potomac. There were disasters. We accomplished absolutely nothing. Then we went to free enterprise. The Wright brothers were successful, as I said, with about $1,500 of their own money, two bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio, figure out the principles of flight, development of the propeller, the wings, the curvature, all of this by themselves. Private money did the work. The Wright brothers put America into the lead to begin the 20th century.
Next person, John D. Rockefeller.
My favorite. Here's a man who's the ultimate Christian entrepreneur, a tither, someone who believed that God called him to do good works, to be an inventor and a businessman, and he certainly showed it. He came from a poor family, not well off like the Wright brothers. His father, in fact, was a bigamist and had another family. Rockefeller traveled around. His father was a quack medicine seller, and Rockefeller, his mother was a strong Christian, so when his father left, she taught him that God will come through for him, and God certainly did. Rockefeller believed in give, and it shall be given unto you, and he became the biggest giver in American history. He also became the best producer of oil in the world. He was so efficient in the way he produced oil. He wanted to be a businessman, and he worked hard in the oil industry. He knew the business well. He produced oil cheaper than anybody else in the world because of his innovations, and he hired the best scientists and chemists that he could, and they did a lot of good work for him. The upshot, Jack, is that Standard Oil in the late 1800s had a 70% market share of all oil sold in the world. Imagine that today. Rockefeller sold more than two-thirds of all oil, just Rockefeller, two-thirds of, with his Standard Oil Company, two-thirds of all oil sold in the world was sold by his company. He became the first billionaire in American history, and he ended up giving away half of his fortune because he was a strong Christian. He gave it to Christian causes, missionaries all around the world. Also, he helped cure meningitis, the problems with the boll weevil, and contributed to black universities like Tuskegee Institute, and he founded Spelman College in Atlanta and named it a black college for women, named after his wife.
One of your eight books is entitled Empire Builders, How Michigan Entrepreneurs Helped Make America Great. And you highlight a bunch of them. Let's talk about two, the first one being Herbert Dow.
Yes, a very good one. I want to say about Rockefeller, he's highlighted in my book, The Myth of the Robber Baron, and I think his story is one of the most fantastic stories that we have about American achievement. Now, Herbert Dow was also very interesting, and I highlight him, as you say, in Empire Builders. And I told his story in a different way. I added some material, reworked the material when I redid it for the book Uncle Sam Can't Count, because I think his story is absolutely fascinating. He's a Michigan entrepreneur, set up shop in Midland, Michigan. But his achievement was to be able to sell chemicals like aspirin, bromine, and magnesium, a variety of chemicals cheaper than anybody else could. The Germans were the greatest chemical producers in the world, but Dow was so effective and so efficient that the Germans at one point wanted him to join them in a worldwide cartel with the Germans plus Dow to try to undercut the world. And Dow just said, no, I'm going to go it on my own. That American independence, you know, I'm not going to try to be successful by using some kind of government power or some kind of maneuvering or leverage. I'm going to do it through individual liberty and through inventiveness. The chemists at Dow Chemical had tremendous number of inventions that they did to improve their products, became a world-class company, and helped Michigan become a great industrial state.
Henry Ford.
Well, Henry Ford is marvelous. And Henry Ford, was an example of someone whose parents died when he was rather young, and he didn't have much, grew up on a farm, and became the wealthiest man, the second billionaire in U.S. history. And it shows what can happen in a nation that values merit and achievement over birth, which is the case in so many other European countries. And Henry Ford, as everybody knows, he had that development of the automobile. He didn't invent it exactly, but he perfected it, and he perfected the assembly line. Henry Ford realized that if he sat and worked on a car, he could build one a day, or his friends might be able to build one or two a day. But in order to put a car in every garage, see, he had a vision. To put a car in every garage, you have to make thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands each day. And so Henry Ford works out the assembly line system to be able to get a lot of people specializing, division of labor, and then he paid the top wages in American industry to get the best people to assemble those parts. And when he did it, he had the greatest invention probably, or one of the greatest of the 20th century, the automobile. And it was, he did put a car in every garage. Over half the cars on the American market in the 1920s were Model Ts, early 20s, were Model Ts. He showed America the way to be a productive industrial power in the 20th century.
One more, Will Kellogg and the Cornflake Crusade.
Will Kellogg is an example of someone who overcame obstacles. His brother was really a physician and the prominent man in the family, and Will worked for him. But Will was the inventor and the entrepreneur. And when he was turned loose, he invented cornflakes accidentally. It's the excitement of an accidental invention. He was putting together a type of wheat grain working for his brother, and he left it out overnight, and it dried out. When he began to pound it apart, he realized it flaked off. He served it to customers at the sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, that his brother had set up, and the patients loved them. They said they were better than what they'd been served before. So the old proverbial Americans make lemonade out of lemons. He took the lemon of the improperly made cereal and made lemonade, went into business, and made cornflakes change breakfast habits of all of Americans with the production of his cornflakes. He also invented, he and his staff invented Rice Krispies, other kinds of breakfast products. And Will Kellogg is an example of someone who decided, instead of thinking small, and he was only making $20 a week as late as age 46, that he would think big to try to produce something that would make a difference, that people would want. He did it and became one of the 20 wealthiest men in the United States.
When we come back, we'll ask Bert Folsom about his latest book, Uncle Sam Can't Count. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Bert Folsom of Hillsdale College. Bert, your latest book, Uncle Sam Can't Count, A History of Failed Government Investments from Beaver Pelts to Green Energy. Tell us about the book.
Well, it's a history of what works and what doesn't work. What works is individual liberty and private companies producing products in an atmosphere of freedom. The United States, as a nation, uniquely has done this, and although other nations have to some extent copied us, we've made it work, and we've showed how it works. When we stumble into the area of government-supported and operated companies, we fail. So I look at industry after industry, what happens when the government gets involved, and what happens when you have private companies operating in the same industry. So you have government-supported companies in the industry, and you have privately supported companies, and the privately supported companies in just about every case end up prevailing. And so the advantages to the United States of limited government become apparent when we look at failed government subsidies from green energy from the fur trade up to green energy. Even George Washington supported a failed government fur subsidy. And we've had failed subsidies to found steamship companies or the transcontinental railroads. But the privately supported transcontinental railroads succeeded. The privately supported steamship company succeeded. The privately supported John Jacob Astor and his American Fur Company, it succeeded. So the private companies end up being the source of wealth for the United States, the source of opportunity in the United States. And the more limited government has been, the better it has been for American economic development.
On June 4th of this past year, you wrote an article entitled James Madison versus Barack Obama, Constitutionalist versus Progressives. What was your message in that article?
The message there is the progressive idea of history, which is that we need to have centralized power and we need to have government, a massive government intervention, that simply hasn't worked. That Madison's idea of individual liberty has worked. And so I was tracing some of Madison's ideas and tracing some of President Obama's ideas and showing how Madison really showed us the way to success. In fact, James Madison, we were going to have, looking at the realm of infrastructure, I was looking at that specifically. Barack Obama favors a lot of federally supported infrastructure. James Madison argued it should be privately done, that the government should not be heavily involved, and that the infrastructure would end up being where the industries were, and the infrastructure would probably be better done. And he vetoed a bill that did federal support for infrastructure, and Madison, in his last full day in office, he did that as president. And so we see contrasting views. But when we've had privately built transcontinental railroads, they worked. When we had federally subsidized transcontinentals, they went bankrupt. So we have a lot of history to help us understand what happens when the government gets too involved. And it often ends up in disaster. And I think these history lessons would be valuable today for us to understand as we try to work our way through public policy.
Speaking of being bankrupt, the $17 trillion debt that keeps growing by $4 billion a day,
yes,
is it insurmountable?
Well, the way you just described it, it almost sounds insurmountable. When it's growing by almost $4 billion a day, that's millions of dollars. I mean, it's grown by tens of millions of dollars since we've been talking. And that almost seems insurmountable. But I tell you what, we have gone through harder periods and overcome the debt there. George Washington was concerned that some people were so pessimistic that we'd ever be able to get rid of our first national debt from the Revolutionary War and having to pay off the people who helped us in the war and having to pay off the French who loaned us money and having to pay off all the Americans who loaned money for the war. But we did it. Washington, in his farewell address, said, hey, we've got to get rid of this national debt. And we did. Not in his lifetime, but we did it in James Madison's lifetime. We paid off the entire national debt. A lot of people didn't think that could be done, and we did. We did it because we were frugal. We did not spend federal money unnecessarily. And we never had an income tax, but we had a protective tariff and we had a whiskey tax. And we were able to pay off the entire national debt. I think those principles, if applied now, would work the same way. If we would stick to the constitutional bases for our spending, and I believe that we could reduce taxes substantially. And by reducing taxes, by the way, I also think that in some cases revenue would actually increase because investors would be stimulated to invest if the tax rates were lower. That's what happened in the 1920s and 1980s. I developed that in a chapter in my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons, how cutting taxes actually stimulated economic growth in the 1920s.
Some listeners tonight say, wow, this man very eloquently says what I believe, but I feel powerless to make a difference. What do you say to those listeners?
It's easy to feel powerless when government is so big and you don't have much influence on that government. And so I can certainly sympathize with that. Also, we're just becoming a bigger nation. But I'd simply say that a lot of people, first of all, you in conjunction with other people, the rise of the Tea Party has been an illustration of what happens when a lot of individuals put their minds together. And if you look at, for example, the 2010 elections, they dramatically shifted the focus of the current administration, and it was a lot of it was individuals and different communities joining their voices together. I think a lot can be done, and just as the stories that I describe in my books of the entrepreneurs, Henry Ford did not look like someone who would be a world changer. He's an orphan. By the time he's a teenager, his parents are both gone. Yet he's in a free country. And in a free country, he has the vision to put a car in every garage, and he does it, in effect. And so I think that same vision, which has propelled Henry Ford and people back to George Washington on up, that same vision is there today. There's enough freedom left that we can still make this country work, and we can still use the individual liberty we have to show that it works, to show that increasing the size of government does not work. President Reagan showed that to some extent in the 1980s. President Coolidge showed it in the 1920s. And we've had illustrations of it happening before, and there's no reason that it can't happen again. We had 94% income tax at the end of World War II under Franklin Roosevelt, and people said, oh, that's the end of creativity. Well, 40 years later, the top rate was 28%. We cut it down. And you don't do that without people who are able to achieve something and make a difference in this world. And I think we can do the same today.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners this evening?
Well, I think the young listeners, the advice that I give them is, first of all, that that Christianity works, that God is a good God, that God gave you natural rights, as we said in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'd say God does not. Our Declaration doesn't promise happiness, but it promises that you can pursue happiness. In other words, that you can follow your dream, that we're going to give you the liberty to follow your dream. If you and God can work out what you are called to do, and you follow that dream, you can have influence and make a difference in this world and accomplish in life what God puts you on earth here to accomplish.
Bert Folsom, you are a modern-day missionary.
Thank you. Teaching
us the values that made America great. Please keep up great missionary work.
Well, I thank you, Jack, and you keep up your good work.
God bless.
God bless you.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.
Believe in yourself.